Over the past 2 years, there have been Fridays, and there have been Fridays, and today is Friday. It's one of those big news days where you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to be retracted. Last Friday was really exciting, and then part of it was inaccurate, so we should all be ashamed of ourselves. Will today's big revelations in domestic politics be retracted? Probably not. I think that's unlikely, but we're going to break it down. We're going to break down the latest on the shutdown. There's a lot there. There's Donald Trump proving his populist credentials yet again. That's going to be exciting. And of course, something with Roger Stone. I hear he's in the news. Seems innocent to me. I like that guy. And then Elizabeth Warren has got a pretty amazing proposal on the cusp of being released. We've got the details on that. A very big idea to potentially fund a number of different progressive priorities while also lowering economic inequality. Also, we have two great guests who are going to be joining us later on in the show. Parker Malloy, editor-at-large at Media Matters, is going to be joining the show in just a little bit to break down some of her analysis of the different lines of attack that the right has launched against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez since she sort of shot into the national spotlight, why that isn't working, and how progressive media can avoid making the same sorts of mistakes in other areas. And then a little bit later on, April Cook Hawkins is going to be joining us. She is a health official and activist that has been working in Flint for a number of years. She's going to give us an update on the situation in Flint right now and talk about the profile that was done of her work in Fahrenheit 11/9 just a few months ago. So lots to get to. We'll be closing out the week with a little bit of fun with Meanwhile In. We're going to take a tour of some bizarre news from around the world a little bit later on. But first, the shutdown. Donald Trump knows that the storyline that the media wants you to believe is that these government workers, the 800,000 workers right now who are in rough times because of this shutdown, are not actually suffering that much. He's not too worried. He's got some tips as well, by the way. So he's a helpful guy. I mean, look, he's made a bunch of different businesses, quite successful, has done very well for himself. He understands how to get things done. And so he's got some advice for people who aren't being paid right now that have the unfortunate necessity of eating food. And here's what the president suggested.
Mr. President, did you see Wilbur Ross said that he doesn't understand why federal workers would need help getting food? Can you understand?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard the statement, but I do understand that perhaps he should have said it differently. Local people know who they are when they go for groceries and everything else. And I think what Wilbur is probably trying to say is that they will work along. I know banks are working along. If you have mortgages, the mortgagees, the folks collecting the interest and all of those things, they work along. And that's what happens in time like this. They know the people, they've been dealing with them for years, and they work along. The grocery store, and I think that's probably what Wilbur Ross meant, but I haven't seen his statement, no. But he's done a great job, I will tell you that.
I don't know. There's a lot there that I don't get. It is very rare that a person can, in a 30-second span, make clear that they don't understand the day-to-day experience of regular people who are struggling and also know absolutely nothing about how things at sort of the top tiers of the economy work either. But he did both. Let's also briefly note, he started that by saying, no, I haven't heard the statement, but maybe he should have said it differently. Well, okay, that's a weird evaluation to make. If you don't know, I don't know what he said, and here is my attempt to interpret in fine detail what I think he said and how he should have said it. Okay, one of those things might be true, I don't know. And then he goes in and says two things. So he's talking, there you're seeing Wilbur Ross saying that he doesn't get, why are people with no money concerned about food? Why don't they just, I don't know, like, I guess he survives on ambient necrotic energy flowing through the universe. He doesn't actually consume carbs or fat or protein or anything like that. Anyway, Donald Trump says, if you are hungry, it's easy. Just what was it, move along, get along? His expression that wipes away all concerns about people losing their houses and businesses. So he says, go to a grocery store and just, you know, get some food and then you pay them later or whatever. So best case scenario, he's advising people to shoplift because the alternative is that he thinks that you just go to stores and everybody knows each other. It's like a sitcom from the 1950s and hey, just put it on my tab, Joe. That's not how supermarkets work. They don't just give you food and then someday you pay them. Not any of the supermarkets I've ever been to either. But it's perhaps not so surprising that Donald Trump doesn't understand how supermarkets work considering some of his past statements about the same subject.
Which is why the time has come for voter ID, like everything else. You know, if you go out and you want to buy groceries, you need a picture on a card. You need ID. You go out and you want to buy anything, you need ID and you need your picture.
What does he think happens in like Stop and Shop? I don't know what he thinks is going on at HEB. First of all, you don't need to like, hey, here's my picture. This is me. This is me. Note the difference in hair. Please let me buy bread. That's not how it works. They don't want your picture. They do, however, want cash. They do want, I guess it's got pictures. It's not my picture. It's like Lincoln's picture. But you do need money. At the same time, this is a businessman. His credential for getting into office was that he understands business. And he said, well, you know, the banks are, they're going to get along. If you've got mortgages and you collect interest, is that what they do? He doesn't get any part of this economy. And is it any surprise? Because he is obviously very wealthy. Much of that money was bequeathed to him from his family. He has stumbled along ever since then, being bailed out by the government at every single turn. And he has probably not set foot in a convenience store for something like the last 30 years. So, of course, he doesn't understand what people who are affected by the shutdown are actually going through. And so he makes buffoonish statements like that. So just briefly, here is some of what is actually going on for real people who exist on the material plane while the shutdown is going on, which, by the way, is in day 35 now, as you can see there. So let's take a look at this. FAA delays flights at New York's LaGuardia Airport, citing staffing shortages amid a government shutdown. Apparently, there are a couple of other airports that are also grounding flights because people are no longer showing up to work. I mean, we talked with an air traffic controller earlier this week, but we know that TSA is also facing rising rates of people not showing up because they haven't been paid for 35 days. It's a big issue. It's sort of significant. Now, they have attempted to reassure people, saying, we've noticed a slight uptick in the people taking sick days. Okay, perhaps it's slight. I imagine that of the people who can survive for 35 days without getting paid, there's probably less that can survive for 36 or 40 or 50 or 100. And so if they're grounding flights at day 35, where are we going to be on day 70 as a country? I think it's going to be a significant problem. And Donald Trump is ready to do something about it, but not really to solve the problem of the shutdown. He just still wants to get his wall. A report has been circulating saying that he has a draft proclamation for a national emergency along the southern border that they're still working on as of a week ago that would also identify $7 billion in potential funds for his border wall. So that money would come from Treasury forfeiture funds, military construction, Pentagon Civil Works funds, and $200 million in Department of Homeland Security funds. None of those funds are intended to build completely optional, unnecessary walls along the southern border. They are intended for some things, though. Those will not be funded. He is going to, if this goes through and he is considering doing it, he is simply going to take that money, tell people who are dealing with, you know, the aftermath of disasters and things like that to just go screw themselves, and he's going to spend it driving steel slats into a couple thousand miles of our border with Mexico. So we are suffering as the shutdown goes on. He has a potential out for himself that involves taking some of your hard-paid tax money and completely wasting it on metal and concrete at the border. What is going on in our country? Anyway, that's day 35. I wonder what day 38 is going to be like. We'll update you on that in just a little bit. We are going to take a short break, though. When we come back, Parker Malloy of Media Matters is going to be joining us to break down some of the right's crusade against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Some of my favorite comedic performances of the last year have been right-wing pundits' attempts to take down new Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by showcasing her dancing and doing her PR team's job of making sure you know exactly what her platform is and how popular it is. So none of those attacks have really worked. Why is that? Joining us now to help break it down, editor-at-large for Media Matters for America, Parker Malloy. Parker, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So you recently did a great write-up showcasing months worth of different strains of attack against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I do want to turn to those in a minute. But before we get to that, I mean, at Media Matters, you're watching these politicians. You're watching the news. From all that you've soaked up surrounding AOC, there's a lot of different arguments as to why she has blown up in the way that she has, whether ideological or demographic or social media or whatever. What do you attribute her success to?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to not take anything away from her. You know, it's easy to say that something about the conservative media reaction has to do with that. But I think that a lot of it has to do with just she's very charismatic and she's got these ideas that are very popular. Like everyone likes the idea of having healthcare. Mm-hmm. Everyone likes the idea of being able to pay for their family's needs. So I think that the combination of those two things really helps, but also you've got this situation where she's a very young candidate. She's a woman, and those combinations often lead to people doing the same old put downs that you see all over the place. You see, oh, she's young, she's inexperienced, she doesn't know what she's talking about, or she'll say something about climate change and they'll go, oh, look at her. She thinks climate change is a real thing. That sort of attitude. I think that it's they thought that tying her to the Democratic Party as some sort of leader, as the face of the Democratic Party, I think has blown up in a giant way because it didn't hurt the Democrats in the midterms. And it did boost her profile. And we saw this happen immediately after she won the she won that primary. You saw in the first 2 or 3 days after that, Fox News was already out there calling her the face of the Democratic Party, which is kind of a ridiculous thing to say about someone who hadn't even been elected to an office just yet, you know? So they did that. It didn't hurt the Democrats. And then you had Sean Hannity putting things on his screen to make them sound bad, like, oh, she wants everyone to get paid a living wage. How is that supposed to be an attack?
Yeah. And I would like to thank them. I mean, I want her to be seen as a leader of the Democratic Party. I want her to be the face of the Democratic Party. And they've done a great job to help make sure that that has happened. I noticed that over the past month or so, ever since the dancing video and the constant attacks against her, she's gained something like 800,000 Twitter followers, eclipsing Nancy Pelosi and the vast majority of everyone else in elected government. So you talked a little bit about some of the particular things that crop up in their attacks very often. I mean, there's the occasional attempt to engage with her on the policy. Generally, it seems to be more of the she's dumb, and it's expressed in the sophisticated form of things like calling her dumb. Or she's crazy, and they love to take screenshots of her to make her look crazy. Considering her identity, should we be particularly surprised that these are the routes that they're taking to attack her?
Oh, of course not. I mean, that seems the obvious approach. And you see this happen with all sorts of politicians. I think the difference here is that she leans into it. She doesn't back down. She doesn't shy away from a fight. One of the things that I've discussed a little bit is how I feel as though during the Texas Senate race, Beto O'Rourke might have been better suited to really lean into some of the attacks from the Texas GOP and Ted Cruz when they would put out things like here, look, here's a photo of him when he was in a band, he was wearing a dress. Like, had he embraced that and just ran with it? Like, there was a video that came out the other day of him wearing a sheep suit and singing the Ramones. That would have been an awesome thing to just embrace, but instead he didn't. And you see kind of what happens when someone really just totally rolls with it. She didn't back down from someone trying to start a narrative that she lied about her upbringing or that she, you know, anything like that. She would just go, no, you're wrong. Here, let me correct this for you and fire back. And I think that her willingness to kind of get in there and say what's on her mind while still, you know, playing smart politics, I think is kind of crucial to her success. And I think that that's a lesson that other politicians of any party could really take from, you know, to be more genuine, more honest. And I think that it's important to stress that more honest and, you know, saying what's on her mind doesn't necessarily mean, because when people think of that with Trump, it's, well, he says the same racist things that everyone's thinking or something along those lines. So this is different. This is just being a genuine human being, which she very, you know, clearly is, and making references that don't sound forced. You know, when she's quoting Watchmen, it doesn't sound like she's telling people to Pokemon Go to watch Watchmen or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I get that reference, by the way. Yeah, and she can make a reference to Super Smash Brothers, and it's not like, dude, Chuck, you've never played as Pikachu, you don't know, you know, Young Link. Like, it's not like that. So I want to dig just a little bit deeper on that, because I know that a lot of other Democrats want to get what she's got in terms of this communication style. And there's the honest angle. I also feel like her ability to be honest is buttressed by the fact that she doesn't take money from a lot of the vested interests that pervert the policies that a lot of Democrats and obviously virtually every Republican pushes for. And so to what extent do you think this is something that other Democrats are either financially or constitutionally actually capable of doing in practice, whether she holds a Twitter seminar or not?
Right. And I think that that's an interesting point of view that I haven't really considered all that much. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, for instance, you know, I mean, on your show, you have more freedom to say what you want than if you were, you know, had an afternoon slot on CNN, you know, where it's held up by all these, you know, super corporate interests. And that's kind of an issue with corporate media in general. And I think the same thing applies to politics.
Yeah.
So I don't know how well it can work in terms of something like someone running for president, but I do think that it's something that people should really play around with more. I mean, maybe Democrats need to say, we can't accept money from super PACs, or we need to, you know, be more open about what our policies are from the beginning. So if anyone does donate, that they know then, you know, what they're donating for, what they're getting, and they're not shaping the policy. I think that's the issue. Too often, politicians shape their policies around what donors want. And if you just have a clear agenda and have a clear policy put out there, people want to donate to support that policy, then that's fine. That's great. You know, that might be one approach, because getting money out of politics completely right now, it's something to aspire to. I don't know if it's something that's going to be a reality anytime in the near future, but I do think that definitely contributes a little bit to her flexibility and her ability to be honest. And I think it also has to do a little bit with the fact that, you know, she comes from a pretty solidly blue district. And I think that it would be unfair to expect someone who's in a swing district to act like her or be like her. And this is something that I've written about as well. The efforts after the midterms, you would see people on TV saying the answer is for Democrats to move to the middle. The answer is for Democrats to move further to the left. And I don't know that there's a one size fits all solution there. I think the answer is for Democrats to just, you know, or any politician to just be honest and be themselves. And she's being herself. This is who she is. And she's clearly representing the interests of her district. And that, I think, is the most important thing. to actually represent the people you are representing.
I certainly agree. We don't have much more time, but I do want to ask you one more question, because as a member of the media, looking at the way that the right wing has inadvertently elevated her far faster than she could have on her own, these constant unforced errors making her look appealing and you know, making her relevant. I do want to look at the other side. So coming from either left media or the more centrist mainstream media, we've kind of done this ourselves, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's what makes it so easy to spot why there were so many of us who could spot this a mile away, where they started attacking her, and it just becomes immediately clear this is not going to go the way you think it's going to go. You saw that happen with Tommy Lahren. That's an example. She had a web series on The Blaze, and then The Daily Show started working it into her segments into their show, and then had her on the show. And if you look at Google Trends, her popularity spiked with that Daily Show appearance. Then she was on The View, and now she's everywhere on Fox News and all over your Twitter feed. So I think that the left has an issue with maybe sometimes accidentally raising the profile of people who are more or less grifters. The Kent State gun girl, for example, is someone who is very clearly trying to go down that route.
Yes.
And I think at this point, a lot of people on the left have caught on to it and are making a concerted effort to not give her what she wants in this. Mm. So better late than never. But I feel like the right hasn't necessarily learned that lesson yet, because they haven't fallen for it before. Is hard as this.
Yeah. So if anyone in the media is watching this, please learn this lesson. Be careful who you give your airtime to. Parker Malloy, Media Matters, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, brief update. Roger Stone's been in the news. I'm going to look up exactly why, and then we'll talk about that. And then Elizabeth Warren, presidential contender, has got a big policy proposal. We'll give you the details after this. Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. We're closing out the week with a little bit of news, some small things probably not worth talking about, but let's get into it anyway. Longtime Trump friend and advisor Roger Stone was indicted and quickly arrested earlier today in connection with special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia and the 2016 election and all of that. We're going to give you the details. Before that, though, I do want to say I absolutely despise talking about Roger Stone. It's one of the things in the news I hate the most. I think it is an indictment of American society that he is able to acquire any political power in the first place, let alone become newsworthy as a result of his involvement in an election. I think it's awful. I think he's awful. And I think that we are all made worse by having to think about or look at him in the first place. That said, here's what he was arrested for. The charges focus on Stone's alleged lies to the House Intelligence Committee during 2017 about his statements about and efforts to get in touch with WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign. The indictment also conspicuously mentions that, quote, a senior Trump campaign official was directed to contact Stone about what WikiLeaks might have on Hillary Clinton. As of this point, that senior Trump campaign official has not been identified. We don't know for sure. Perhaps at some point we will. The evidence that people are talking about implies that it is Steve Bannon, but I would not consider that to be any sort of guarantee or verified fact at this point. So there's 7 counts. They have to do with lying to the House Intelligence Committee. But we do have to acknowledge the indictment does not attempt to explain why Stone would lie about this or lay out a definitive story about what did happen between Stone and WikiLeaks back then. Stone also has not been charged with any criminal activity occurring during the campaign. So all of the indictments right now, the reason he was arrested, are about charges that came about from activities after the election. Now, there are activities that related to the election, but they are not specifically alleging crimes during the time of the election. They are all after 2016. So bear that in mind. But in the indictment, the documentation that the Mueller team put forward, there is information about some of what was going on during 2016. So part says, after the July 22nd, 2016 release of stolen DNC emails by Organization One, widely believed to be WikiLeaks, a senior Trump campaign official was directed to contact Stone about any additional releases and what other damaging information Organization One had regarding the Clinton campaign. Stone thereafter told the Trump campaign about potential future releases of damaging material by Organization One. So although the charges and indictments don't say that he committed crimes in these activities, they do make clear that they have a documented paper trail of him communicating with people in the know about what WikiLeaks was going to release, him giving the Trump campaign sort of a heads up about it so that messages could be coordinated, and sort of a timeline mapped out based on that. A little bit more, we could go into a great deal of detail about this. It pains me to go even into this detail, but here is some of what went on the back and forth during that time period. On July 25th, 2016, Stone emailed Corsi, one of the guys that pops up a lot in Stone-related stuff, and also part of the indictments have to do with him threatening Corsi, telling him to, quote, get to Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and get the pending WikiLeaks emails. Corsi forwarded this email to an overseas individual that is not specifically identified. On July 31st, just 1 week later, Stone wrote to Corsi that Ted Malik, a Trump campaign advisor, should see Assange. A little bit later, on August 2nd, Corsi emailed Stone claiming knowledge of Assange's plans. Quote, word is friend in embassy plans two more dumps, one shortly after I'm back from a trip in Europe, second in October, impact planned to be very damaging, end quote. That's from Corsi. Quote, would not hurt to start suggesting HRC old, memory bad, has stroke, neither he nor she well. I expect that much of next dump focus setting stage for Clinton Foundation debacle. Okay. So based on the documents that were eventually released, we know that regardless of exactly how the information was communicated, what was alleged in these emails between Corsi and Stone was borne out. That was the information that WikiLeaks had access to. The Trump campaign was given a heads up to start to coordinate that message. And you saw that those stories, whether about the Clinton Foundation or the more specific stuff about Hillary Clinton having a bad memory or having a stroke, was disseminated, and right-wing pundits went crazy with that stuff. And that was one of the storylines attacking Hillary in advance of the 2016 election. So part of that, hypothetically, did come from this coordination that was going on right now. Now, despite all of that communication back and forth, by 2017, Stone was putting forward an apparent cover story for whatever actually did happen in 2016, which we don't know much about at this point. He was insisting that everything he heard about Assange and WikiLeaks came from just one person, talk radio host Randy Credico, whom he called his, quote, intermediary. So when Stone went to testify before the House Intelligence Committee in closed session in September 2017, he stuck to that story. Mueller has indicted Stone on 5 counts of false statements during that testimony. So, as with some other people, most of the crimes involve lying to investigators looking into all of this. So at this point, as some contrarians who always jump to the defense of Trump and his team when these sorts of stories come out have pointed out, it's entirely possible that he was lying about all of this, but no crime underlying the lies was actually committed. That is possible. It seems a little hard to believe, a little nonsensical, why Roger Stone, as well as so many other people orbiting around Donald Trump, just decided that they were going to lie to the House, they were going to lie to the FBI, they were going to lie to the Mueller team constantly about all of these topics, totally independently, and to cover up no crimes. They could have done that. I don't really understand why you would do that, since they seem to be aware of the fact that you could go to jail for that. And he potentially faces a couple of years in jail, depending on exactly, you know, what the judge adjudicates with the crimes that are alleged. Now, Donald Trump has responded, saying, greatest witch hunt in the history of our country, no collusion. Border coyotes, drug dealers, and human traffickers are treated better. Who alerted CNN to be there? So that is their conspiracy theory that has developed in the wake of CNN seeing the arrest. CNN has responded, we got there through journalism. There was grand jury activity last night, which is similar to what has happened in advance of other arrests. So we staked out Roger Stone's place because he has been one of the perceived targets of this going forward. So that seems like a bit of a dodge. He is already out, by the way, on a $250,000 bail. He has that privilege that all rich people have where he didn't pay any of that yet. It's just if he violates the bail, he has to pay. Many people around the country are staying in jail because they can't pay their bail. But for him, the $250,000 is this ephemeral, wispy thing that he doesn't ever have to actually pay. So he says he's going to plead not guilty. He gave the old Nixon thing, and people are pointing out that's a bad thing to do if you want to get across that you're innocent. I think he knows that. He is a troll, okay? Like, he's an objectionable person in virtually every way, but I think he's making a joke there. Just heads up to the media. There's a lot of stuff to attack Roger Stone over. I think he gets that. Anyway, stupid story in a stupid timeline in the stupid state that America has seen itself in. We'll have more details if and when they ever develop. That said, I do want to turn to a much more important story. Elizabeth Warren is going to be running for the presidency, and she is going to do that largely based on her progressive pedigree on economic issues, regulation issues, and big ideas. And so she has another one, and it is a wealth tax. So the details are not specific as to Elizabeth Warren, but the people who are advising her on this wealth tax do give us an idea of what it might include. So, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman, two left-leaning economists at the University of California, Berkeley, have been advising Warren on a proposal to levy a 2% annual wealth tax on Americans with assets above $50 million, as well as a 3% wealth tax on those who have more than $1 billion. So, why would you do this? What does this mean? Well, bear in mind that income inequality over time has been getting worse and worse as more and more of the total share of the wealth that is owned by all Americans has flowed to the 1% and to a much greater extent, the top 0.1%. If you bring up this chart, you're going to see that the top 1% now owns as much as the bottom 95%. By the way, the top 0.1% owns as much as the bottom 90%. So it has been getting worse and worse over the past few decades. The economic collapse of a little bit over a decade ago obviously made that worse. Things have become a little bit more equal during the last years of Obama's presidency. Since 2015, we don't have data specifically there, so I'm not sure exactly what happens there. But things are bad in terms of income inequality. And whenever progressives put forward ideas like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, public college, policies like that, the counterpoint from everyone is, but how are you going to pay for it? Okay, so here's one potential way. Nobody seems to like that in the center and in the establishment. But what would it do? This wealth tax is estimated to raise $2.75 trillion over a 10-year period from about 75,000 families, or less than 0.1% of US households. So this wealth tax would never affect you. It would never affect you. It would never, ever, ever affect you. I just want to make sure that you know that, because when you watch Sean Hannity, they're going to say that plumbers are going to be devastated by Elizabeth Warren's radical wealth tax. That's not how it would work. You would only do this if you had over that gigantic threshold of wealth. It would only affect you then. And there's a lot more details in terms of how you actually institute this, how you enforce this. A lot of it drawn from examples in Western Europe, where these sorts of wealth taxes still exist in a number of different countries. This is this is a higher tax than in some of those countries, less in others. And something like this is likely to be necessary for these gigantic progressive ideas to actually be put into effect. By the way, I love the synergy here where Elizabeth Warren has this proposal for a wealth tax about how negative the accumulation of great wealth can be, which is obviously, that's something found in the writings of the founding fathers, their concerns about dynastic wealth. AOC earlier this week was talking about how every billionaire is a policy failure and it's immoral and all of that. So great synergy here between Congress and the Senate as well. We're going to have much more on this a little bit later on today on the Young Turks, and we'll be doing more coverage here. We're attempting to get Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman on the show to talk about how this wealth tax would actually be put into effect. But as of right now, a very interesting idea, helps to shift the Overton window on exactly how we fund these things, and we'll have more in the future. We are going to take a short break, back with much more after this. I get that our country faces a lot of different problems, and we try to cover as many as we can here. But it is unfortunate that the previous conversation that we were having nationally about the tragedy going on in Flint largely has fled from the news. You don't hear about it much anymore. But is the situation there actually much improved? Joining us now to help update us on the situation is activist April Hawkins. April, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're very glad to have you here and to get us up to date on what's actually going on there, especially since we hear so little about it nationally. So I know that you've been involved in this tragedy for some time. How did you initially get involved in what was going on in Flint?
Just being a regular community activist here. And then when the water crisis hit, we kind of shifted our gears a little bit from violence to the community water crisis.
So what was your position at that point?
I was still an activist here in Flint, and I was also the lead case manager at the county.
So you were recently, a part of your story was profiled in Fahrenheit 11.9. And it was fascinating to see some of what was going on sort of behind the scenes as this issue was developing before people were really familiar with it. So for those who might not have yet seen the documentary, what were you talking about in there?
Well, I was talking about my role working there as the lead case manager and how we had to input the different lead levels and how things were behind the scene a little complicated for me because they were asking me to do things that I didn't feel comfortable doing. And I chose to resign because I just didn't want that type of blood on my hands.
So they actually wanted you to falsify the lead testing information, and let's be clear, about children, implying that they had less lead in their system than they actually had, correct?
Absolutely.
It's difficult to imagine something more abhorrent than the government trying to do that. And the reason I want to ask you about this is because I think that a lot of people's perception about Flint is that this was just an unfortunate accident, or it was a series of they really made mistakes there. But your story implies that there was a bit more sort of willful negligence to this story. Would you describe it that way?
I would describe it that way, yes. This was a man-made disaster. This wasn't an accident or anything like that.
And we did, thankfully, during the 2016 election, there was a little bit of talk about Flint. There was the idea that perhaps something would be done. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like that's been a big priority from Donald Trump. But in that media coverage about Flint, is there any other ways the media sort of got the situation wrong or didn't report on it in a way that you would have felt would be more accurate?
I just think that they can keep the Flint water crisis more in the media because so many things is going on down here, well, here in the city, even the fact that we're still using bottled water. And some people think that the crisis is over when it's not. We still have to use bottled water to cook, bathe, everything with.
Yeah, and that I would have to guess that for many people across America, that is not their perception, that it's still at that level of the response to it. So you said that there's more going on there. What are we missing nationally? What else are the people of Flint sort of struggling with as this tragedy continues?
Well, like the pipes, there have been a little progress with getting all the pipes replaced, but they are behind in the pipes. So we're still living with that, with the tainted pipes, as well as people are losing their homes because of not even paying, you know, their water bills. I wouldn't want to pay my water bill either when you can't even use the water.
Yeah, exactly. And I would have to imagine that for many of the people in Flint who are homeowners, their property value has got to still be suffering as a result of both the tragedy and the public perception around the tragedy. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so tragedy on top of tragedy. If you were able to communicate with the governor, with the federal government, what would you want them to do in Flint to actually resolve this situation?
I think infrastructure is major. We have to replace this infrastructure. So my ask would be to assist us with that so that we can live like normal human beings. There's no way we should have to live like we're in a third world country. And on top of that, to have the highest water bills in the country is just a lot.
Yeah, I don't understand how that situation is tenable. The least access to water potentially across the country and to also suffer with the financial consequences there. And I'm also curious, we always try to, for the people who are watching the show, we try to give them some sort of in to get involved with the issues that are going on in the country. For those who are watching this, is there anything they can do to actually help the people of Flint?
Absolutely. I know that for our church and what we do, because we kind of tailor towards we have a program called Flint 4000, and that helps the homebound citizens that even though we do have some type of water distributions, they have no way of getting water. They can't leave their homes. We're dealing with people that are handicapped, blind, and just can't leave home. So we would love to get some type of assistance with that. And majority of them are elderly people.
Wow. So even worse to imagine that those people are still being left behind, even after we've known about this tragedy now for multiple years.
Yes.
April
yes.
Hawkins, I want to thank you for joining us on the show and giving us an update on what's going on in Flint.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Anytime. We're going to take a short break. We come back. We've covered a little bit of what's going on in America. Now we turn our sights abroad. What's going on around the world? After this. Here in America, we have got breaking news. Apparently, Donald Trump, this is according to the Washington Post, is going to announce a deal to end the shutdown. That deal would fund government to continue for at least some period and put off consideration of wall funding until a later date. That is a deal, technically. It sounds to me like just funding government and not, you know, engaging in this nonsense tangent that has nothing to do with the actual funding of government. But look, if that means that we no longer, if we don't have to iterate to day 36, if that means 800,000 federal workers will actually be paid, then that is great news. I will only briefly say, haha, you loser, Donald Trump, you got beat. The important thing is that we resolve the shutdown, assuming that's actually what he does, and this is not some sort of dodge so that when he goes in the Rose Garden and announces it, it's national emergency and I'm king for life stuff. But we'll have to see. While that is going on, meanwhile in Australia, bats are dying all over the place. So last week, researchers from Western Sydney University finalized their conclusion that about 23,000 spectacled flying foxes, how did they get the spectacles on them, died in an event of heat and bad weather on November 26th and 27th. That is a very short period of time to lose 23,000 of those bats. They often experience fatal heat stress when temperatures eclipse 42 degrees Celsius, scientists say. During November's heat wave, one area recorded its highest ever temperature of 42.6 degrees Celsius. And so, look, the reason we talk about this is not because I have some sort of vested interest in bespectacled flying foxes, but that this is one little thing happening in one little area of the world that gives you an idea of how bad this is. And much of the lessons that you can learn from these bats can be applied over gigantic areas of the Earth's surface. This is the sort of thing that we should expect, that at the same time that like hundreds of thousands of reindeer are dying in the Arctic because the tundra is melting and anthrax is being released and all that, that's a little thing that you don't pay attention to. There's a little thing with bats in Australia. These sorts of things start to add up when you have climate change across the entirety of the Earth's surface. So very unfortunate, both for the bats and for the Earth. And meanwhile in what is that? Meanwhile, in Florida, Ron DeSantis' new Secretary of State is now his old Secretary of State because he was forced to resign after photos emerged of him. Well, let's take a look. That is Mike Ertl, who once was Secretary of State. He's in blackface and he's wearing a New Orleans Saints bandana wrapped around his head. He's got big earrings on, and although you can't see it in that photo, apparently in some of the other photos, his shirt says Katrina victim. Now, if these photos were from last Wednesday, this is unfortunate. But it's actually worse than that, because these are not from last Wednesday. These are from 2 months after Hurricane Katrina, meaning that just 60 days after 1,800 Americans died, he thought, those people are funny. Their life experience is a laugh riot. That's my Halloween costume for this year. So I would say too soon now, definitely too soon, 2 months after Hurricane Katrina. In response to this is the stepping down, Ron DeSantis said, it's really unfortunate because he's done great work. Odd that Ron DeSantis doesn't have a problem with the insane racism implicit in that costume. Weird how that works out. And meanwhile, Lynn, this is an unfortunate one. Meanwhile, in Brazil, an openly gay congressman has left his job over pervasive death threats that have come about as a result of him openly clashing with Brazil's new fascist anti-gay president, Jair Bolsonaro. In an interview published by a daily newspaper, Congressman Gene Willis said he was currently outside of Brazil and had no plans to return. Instead, he said he would work in academia, but did not actually say where. He said his decision to leave wasn't just because of Bolsonaro's rise, but rather the climate of heated rhetoric and intensifying violence towards members of the LGBT community in the wake of last year's campaigns. So this, just within the context of this story, having to do with Brazil, this is a tragedy that in Brazil, which is, that is a major country, that you would not only step down from being an elected official, but you would flee your country over threats against you. But also, stepping just a little bit wider, How many times on this show did we talk about Bolsonaro and what he would represent for Brazil? Not just that he himself is anti-gay, not just that in Brazil there are people who care so little about that community that they would vote for someone like Bolsonaro, but that they are both made worse when you give one political power and you give another political cover. That you get someone like Bolsonaro in office, and then other people start to feel like, hey, maybe this position I have, this hatred I feel in my heart, not so bad. Maybe I should actually act in it, and maybe I should threaten some elected officials. You think Bolsonaro really cares about that? Probably not, but we should, because I see this sort of thing happening in the US as well. Okay, thank you for joining us. Great to have you here all throughout this week. We'll see you Monday morning with more. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.